settle, no. But we won't remain silent, no. It's hard to find lonely. We sing from the heart. We sing from the heart, no. But we won't become complacent, no. It's a rock and roll nation. We sing from the heart.
This is Sully from the podcast, The Indefensible Middle Ground, and that was The Slants with From the Heart. If you want to hear the whole song, go to our YouTube and hear them performing that song live on the steps of the Supreme Court. Beautiful, beautiful rendition of it. Unplugged. Just Joe, the guitarist, and Ken, the lead singer, singing it. It's absolutely beautiful. I wanted to go ahead and post some more The Slants audio. Right now, I want to introduce Simon Tam. This is his speech that he gave at the Electric Maid. I apologize, we're missing a little bit of the intro, but enjoy and glean from it what you will. It's basically his life story and how he wanted to make this band. And I'm blown away because after spending the week with them, I have to say, these guys should be the role models for anybody who wants to get involved in changing things, to get involved in social justice. Don't go light a car on fire. Be Simon Tam. Be The Slants. These guys are awesome. So here, without more jibber jabber, here is Simon Tam and his speech at Electric Maid on January the 18th after their Supreme Court hearing.
This came about a number of years ago. I was actually seeing somebody who lived in Tallahassee, Florida, while I lived in Portland, Oregon. So, long distance relationship, almost as long as you can get in this country. But over that time period, all of a sudden, my partner's father wanted to meet me. And so I thought, okay, you know, he called me up. He says, "Hey, Simon, I heard you like sushi." And I was like, "That's true. I do. And the sushi in this town's all right. Dim sum's awful, but sushi's okay." So he said, "Let's go ahead and meet up for lunch." And so I agreed to do that. And, you know, of course, I'm trying to make a good impression. First time meeting a partner's father, you want to make sure that you kind of, you know, are accepted into the family, so to speak. As we were there, we walk into the restaurant, and as soon as we sit down, before we even get the menus, he looks at me and he says, "Well, you're the expert here, so why don't you just go ahead and order for all of us?" And so I thought, what's he trying to say here? You know, I wasn't quite sure what he was assuming. And back then, I didn't have the terminology for this. I now know it nowadays as a social justice advocate. Social justice activists know this as a microaggression, or like kind of the subtle indignity that a person of color has to face. But back then, I was like, is that like a racist stereotype? Do I give him a pass on it? So I was like, okay, well, I don't want to like call him a racist to his face or anything like that. So I said, you know what? I don't really know what you like or don't like, so how about we each choose something, and then we could all kind of try each other's thing. How does that sound? You know? So I just let him off the hook on that one a little bit. And he says, okay, but I want you to order in your language. Damn, I want to give it to him. Like, okay. You know, so then I finally responded by saying, well, actually, I was born and raised in San Diego, so my language is English. I was like, that being said, you know, Chinese people aren't necessarily known for sushi. That's generally Japanese, and we're in a Japanese restaurant. Great, right? But then he keeps talking. And he says to me, he says, well, you're all the same, right? You know, ironically, the server who came by was actually from northern China, so I could order my language of Mandarin. But that's besides the point, right? And it kind of goes to the heart of this, that it's not just about intention when we kind of step into the murky waters of race and identity, but it's also about impact. How are people impacted by the words we use and the choices that we make in our daily lives? You know, growing up in San Diego during the 80s, a lot of people were surprised that I experienced a lot of racism because they're like, well, that's San Diego, it's such a diverse place. But they don't realize that there's these subtle indignities, kind of like at the restaurant, that one has to face. In my parents' example, one immigrated from the Canton area of China. Another one immigrated from Taiwan. They came here, barely speaking the language, and had to endure unimaginable difficulties in order to get here. That's a story for another day. But, you know, one thing that they wanted to do was to make sure that their kids could be successful and that their kids didn't have to endure some of the struggles that they had to. So before I even entered preschool, my parents, in almost like a stereotypical tiger mom kind of situation, made me study math and writing and reading well before I entered in school. So that when I finally got into the elementary school and kind of took their placement test at kindergarten, I was reading and writing at a third grade level and doing math at a fourth grade level. So the school says, you know, hey, that's no problem at all. We're not worried about them. But they told my parents, I didn't learn about this until about 2 years ago. They told them, we're not worried about Simon. We're actually worried about you. And they said, you know, they basically told my parents to never speak to me in my native tongue, in any of the first three languages that I learned, Mandarin, Taiwanese, and Cantonese, that they should only respond to me in English if I wanted to fit in so that I could properly learn the language and kind of assimilate better into the school. And that's why to this day, I'm actually illiterate in my native tongue, and I can't speak two of those languages anymore. Barely can speak Mandarin these days. And that was just one of those things, because their intent was to try and help me succeed, but the impact was devastating to me in that I had lost substantial amounts of my culture. And, you know, as I kind of navigated the school system and started growing up, I realized that it wasn't all that it was cracked up to be. You know, here in school, we were learning about culture and we're learning about history. None of it had to do with my history, my family's history, or the things that we had experienced. And at the same time, I felt like I was just getting killed out there. You see, starting in about fourth grade, I was attacked multiple times, called a chink, called a Jap, called a gook, as people would kick my stomach over and over again, throw balls at my face, beat my head in with rocks, of which that's why I have a scar on the top of my head today. Told that even though I was born here, that I didn't belong here. I mean, constantly being told to go back to where I came from, even though that was the city where I was born and lived my entire life. That was the experience I had. And whenever I told school administrators, they kind of looked the other way, saying, boys will just be boys. You know, it didn't really occur to me how to stop them until kind of this one specific moment. I remember I was in eighth grade, I was in the schoolyard, and I was just getting pummeled. And these kids were just yelling at me, and they kept yelling at these racial slurs. They kept calling me a gook and a Jap over and over again as they're kind of beating down on me. And I remember at one point I was just so frustrated, I turned to them and I said, "You know what? I'm a chink. If you're going to be racist, at least come at me with right racism." And at that moment, they actually stopped. They were stunned. They just didn't know how to respond to that, and they walked away. Later on in high school, I kind of realized that kind of sometimes reclaiming a stigmatizing label or a negative word can have additional power, or sometimes reclaiming a stereotype and turning it upside down. You know, when I was in high school, my best friend Kyle and I, we were like the only punk rockers at our high school. Like, so this is before Hot Topic was even around. And this was, you know, the early 90s. So he came to school one day with this really, really bright hot pink hair, like with like Liberty spikes. So, I mean, just foot and a half spikes all over his head. And I was like, "Oh, you're being so punk rock." You know, but the other kids didn't like that so much. The other students were just making fun of them. And we were actually in front of the high school, and they would just call them horrendous things. And they kept calling them a fag and a queer and just all manner of things. Right there, right in front of the school, where parents were picking up the other students. And school administrators are just walking by saying, like, you know, "These guys are troublemakers." And they kept saying these things, saying things like, "Why did your mom let you walk out the door looking like that?" And finally, I stepped in and I said, "Maybe it's because his mom isn't like stupid and ignorant like all of you are." Well, that wasn't the greatest life decision. So they turned around and immediately directed all their anger and fury and whatever was going through them at me instead. And they kept saying over and over again, like, "Oh, what up, Jackie Chan? You know, what are you going to do, Jackie Chan?" And I was like, "Well, first of all, I don't look anything like Jackie Chan." Like, Jackie Chan's kind of a badass. And I took karate camp for 1 week. This is not equivalent. But again, the only thing I could think of at that time was to put that 1 week of karate camp to that knowledge in place. And I just kind of struck a little kung fu pose, a little martial arts pose. And they were just like, "Whoa, hold on a second. We don't want any of that." So then they walked away. And one of the few times that actually a stereotype helped me, right? So, you know, these experiences as a teenager were obviously devastating. So much so that to this day, I still regret saying this to my dad, where I walked up to him and I said, "Dad, I'm ashamed of being Chinese." It broke his heart, especially after all he'd done to try and escape into communist China to bring his family here. And he's like, "Well, how could you say that?" And I'm like, "Dad, I'm getting killed out there every day. Like, they're just targeting me because I have these slanted eyes, because of my hair, because of how I look. I wish I could change that. I wish I didn't, you know, I wish I didn't have to bring food that they thought was smelly, because I just get it thrown in my face all the time." And it was all these experiences that kind of shaped it, where I wanted to just walk away from my culture. And I kind of did. I was like, "You know what? I don't even want to think about being Chinese anymore." Ironically, it wasn't until I moved to Portland, Oregon. That was about early 2000s. I had this brilliant idea of dropping out of college 2 months before graduating in a double major program so I could tour this punk rock band called The Stibs. But as I moved across the country to do this, leaving like everything and everyone behind, I started missing my culture. So to kind of make up for it, I would import movies on like VHS tapes from eBay, like from Hong Kong. Every one of those Jackie Chan films, every single one. And I will tell you, that's a whole lot of them. And during that time, got really into movies about the triads, which are kind of like Asian mafia movies. And around that time, someone's like, "You know, if you like these kind of Asian mafia movies and these martial art films and things like that, you should check out the movie Kill Bill. Because, like, I think you'd really enjoy that." So I said, "Okay, sure." You know, I missed it in the theaters at the time because I was on tour. But I bought it the day it came out on DVD. And there's this, like, really iconic scene in the film. How many of you have seen Kill Bill? So, like, okay, good chunk of it here. Really iconic scene where this woman, Orny, she walks into the restaurant with her gang of crazy 88s or her Yakuza Asian Mafia behind her. And it's like, to anybody else, this is just another trademark Quentin Tarantino scene. But for me, it was an epiphany. It was so powerful, I just had to pause the film right there in the middle of it. Because for me, it was the first time I had ever seen an American-produced film that depicted Asians in that positive way, of being cool, confident, and sexy. Think about that, growing up your entire life and never seeing your own culture displayed like that in your own home country. So it was just like just an awakening at that particular moment. And that's when I decided that things would have to change. Because I realized in my own art, the same art that I dropped everything in my life to follow, music, there was no representation. That despite having over 17 million Asian Americans in this country, we had no representation on the Billboard charts. There were never Asian Americans on the cover of Rolling Stone magazine. There weren't any Asian Americans in any music videos on MTV back when they used to play music videos. So I wanted to change that, and I decided I would change it by starting a band that would be deliberate in celebrating our Asian American culture. The problem was, I moved to Portland, Oregon, and for those of you who don't know, Portland is often known as America's whitest city. So I didn't know any Asians. And so the only thing I could do was post posters and flyers at sushi restaurants, at dim sum restaurants, at the shopping center, use Craigslist, the local papers, and of course, this is, you know, gotta remember, 2004, I used MySpace.com. I was posting bulletins up the wall there. It took me 2.5 years, but eventually I kind of got a lineup together and began touring. But what's interesting is that during that time of kind of searching for these mythical Asian American musicians in the city of Portland, someone had invited me to an anime convention. An anime convention out there called KomoriCon. And I thought, you know, this is great. Yeah, I'm going to go there. I'm going to meet all kinds of Asian people. Maybe someone will play music and we're just going to kill it. How many of you here have been to an anime convention? Okay. Well, you know, I don't know about the ones out here, like in the mid-Atlantic region, but in Portland, Oregon, there's not a lot of Asians there. And I kind of found out in an interesting way. So the first time ever going to an anime convention, which I will say is different than going to a Comic-Con, I'm walking up the steps. And all of a sudden, I hear this little voice, like, I don't know, maybe 50, 100 feet away from me, and they just yell, "Asian!" And I'm like, where? Because I'm trying to find somebody. You know? And I turn around, and she runs and tackles me to the ground. And then she gets up and just scrambles away. And I was like, what the heck just happened? And my friends were like, oh, you just got glomped. And I was like, glomped? I don't, what does that mean? Why did they do that? And they're like, oh, because, you know, we love Asian culture here, and there's like never any Asians. And I was like, why didn't you tell me this beforehand? But what I did find was a group, thousands of kids who are interested in Asian culture. And to me, that was a powerful moment because, you know, walking through the dealer's hall, I see people selling CDs. I'm always interested in that part. And I'm flipping through the disc, and I realize they're all import CDs. So 40, 50, 60 bucks a pop. And I was like, hold on a second, like, who would spend all that money on these little CDs from Japan? And as I'm doing that, two teenage girls walk up. One says, hey, have you ever heard of this group? And the other one's like, no, but it looks pretty cool. And it's only $55, so I think I'm going to buy it. And as a musician, I was like, this sounds like a pretty good market. So I went home, and I emailed them, and I said, hey, I play in an all-Asian American band called The Slants, I'll play your convention, you know, blah, 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 what do you think? The funny thing is I didn't actually have anybody in my band. I photoshopped pictures of actors from Hong Kong movies that I loved, projecting that I would find them in time for this event. They found out I was Asian, and they're like, yes, come on in, you will be our guest of honor next year. And, you know, people were telling me I was crazy. They're like, why would you play an anime convention? And I'm like, it's going to be great. It's going to be awesome. Just trust me on that. And finally, we did get that lineup together, and we did play. And what was amazing is that these kids were like singing along to our songs that they never heard before. Like hundreds of them were jumping up and down and dancing, and I thought this is such an incredible experience. At least in the concert portion. Because when I was interacting with some of them in the hallways and hanging out in the dealer's hall, things were a bit different. For example, people would walk up at this anime convention and say, hey, they'd grab our CD and say, which one of these songs are in Japanese? And I'm like, well, my singer, he's actually Vietnamese, so he doesn't sing in Japanese. And they would just look really disappointed, put it down, and walk away. Another time, someone did that, and I was like, and they tried it, and they just said, "Oh, which one of you guys are Japanese?" And I was, "Are you guys an all Japanese band?" I'm like, "No, we're kind of like this Pan Asian buffet. We got a little bit of this and a little bit of that, you know." I was like, "But we're not an all Japanese band." And they're like, "Well, what are you?" I'm like, "What am I?" I was like, "You mean what? You know, what's my ethnicity?" They're like, "Yeah." And I said, "Well, I'm Chinese, Taiwanese, born in the U.S." And they're like, "Oh, you're the wrong kind of Asian to be here." And I was like, "The wrong kind of Asian? What about all these Caucasians running this thing?" I was like, "You gotta be kidding me. Wrong kind of Asian." And they're like, "Yeah, well, you know, we're here to celebrate Japanese culture, okay? Japanese anime. That's what we're here for, so I don't know what you're doing here." I was like, "Excuse me, I just saw Jack Sparrow giving a stormtrooper a high five next to a guy dressed like he's from Tetris. So I don't know how that relates to Japanese animation and why you think they belong, but I don't." So it felt like no matter where we went, we weren't quite fitting in. I remember another time in Tulsa, Oklahoma, playing at a different convention, this kid runs up to me in the elevator, and he just says, hey, do you speak Japanese? And I'm like, "No, I'm sorry, I don't." And he says, "Well, what does watashiwa mean?" And I was like, "Well, actually, I do recognize that. That's Japanese. But I just said I don't speak Japanese. Sorry." And it was like kind of this thing over and over again that I realized, you know, for better or worse, we would continually be judged for our identity. One time, a newspaper in Portland, Oregon, hometown paper, they decided to write a review about us, and they started it with, "OMG, I get it, the slants are Asian. But what's so impressive about a bunch of Asian kids who play keyboards?" And then they proceeded to tell us how we had confidence issues because we decided to rock synthesizers instead of other musical instruments. That's been kind of the journey of like playing an Asian American band. You deal with identity issues that non-Asian bands might not necessarily have to face. One of the most devastating times in my particular career was one time when I got an offer from a major record label. In fact, it was like not just a record label, it was like the record label. The label that had all my favorite bands as a kid. The label that when I was 10 years old, I was like, I even wrote them letters at 10 years old saying, "One day I will be on your label. One day I will be playing bass with some of my heroes here." So imagine my just delight and shock when they contact me wanting to meet. And then imagine the brokenness that I felt when they said, "We love everything about your band. We love you guys, but we just have one small thing we need to change." And I was like, "Well, what is it?" I said, "We need to change your lead singer with somebody who's white." And they said, "Asian doesn't sell." And of course, I was like, "That's racist. I'm not going to stand by that." So we continued on. You see, because from the very beginning, our band has kind of embedded this idea of activism with our art. When I was at those anime conventions, I started getting asked to participate in panels, not just of like the kind of panels of like, what Japanese bands or what anime do you like, but what's it like to be an Asian in America? And I got to address a lot of the stereotypes that we had faced, a lot of the struggles that I had faced in my personal life. So I was thrilled to share that particular story. One time, I was at this anime convention in Chicago, Anime Central. For those of you who don't know, that's a pretty big, you know, it's a legit con. It's got about 15,000 to 20,000 kids up there. And I was just in this area that they call Artist Alley, signing autographs, selling CDs, making very poor art, and giving it away, and doing some panels too. But as I was looking through the panel booklet, I saw a panel called How to Pick Up an Asian Guy or Girl. And I was like, oh, that sounds very interesting. I talked to my friend, she's an Asian artist who also appears at these conventions. I was like, look at this, How to Pick Up an Asian Guy or Girl. What do you think about that? She's like, I think we should go. And I was like, I agree. So we went, and this is a huge panel room, like about 400 or 500 kids. I mean, just jam-packed. And I was like, you guys were talking about this. We're like, it sounds like How to Pick the Right Breed of Dog for You or something like that. So let's go over there and just check out and see what it's all about. We go, and we were waiting there for about 5 or 10 minutes, and no one stepped into the mic. And I was like, hey, I think we should run this panel. And she's like, okay. So we run up, because the volunteers are like, they didn't show up. And I was like, hey, we're here to run this panel. So we hijacked it. We said, so, you know, show of hands, what did you guys think of this particular panel title? How many of you found this offensive? And about a third of the room actually raised their hands. And in this case, Chicago, a little more diverse than Portland, Oregon, all the hands raised just happened to be the Asian attendees. Very quickly, you could tell who had their hands down. But it was awesome because we finally got to have a real conversation, a sincere one. We were like, you know what? Let's address every stereotype that you have right now. Every single one. Nothing's off the table, and we'd like to talk about it right now. You know, you want to talk penis size? You want to talk about other forms of genitalia, whether we can drive or not, whether we use chopsticks to eat pizza? Because, yes, those were all questions that they had asked. Like, we're here to answer it and be very straight up about it. And, I mean, one time, one person was really disappointed that the panel turned out differently than they thought. So their question was like, well, hey, I really like this girl, this Japanese girl. I want to know how I could, like, date her. Should I've been practicing using chopsticks. Should I ask her to go out to, like, sushi? Or should I ask her to go out to, eat some ramen? And my friend's partner was actually Italian, so not Asian. And we're like, hey, you somehow managed to, like, score an Asian woman as a partner. Like, what do you think? What advice do you have? And he goes up there and he says, hey, you know, so can I ask what your ethnicity is? And the kid, he says, yeah, I'm Italian. He's like, oh, cool, I'm Italian too. He's like, what do you know? He's like, let me ask you, what if we turn this situation around? What if this girl that you like went up to you and asked you, will you go out with me? I've been practicing using forks. Sometimes I put them in my hair. We can go eat spaghetti and pasta. What would you think about that? And the guy's like, that'd be totally weird. It's like, of course it would be weird. So those are some of the kind of situations that we've come across. And you know, panels that we had led. We did this for about 18 months, touring around the country, leading discussions on racism and identity, kind of playing at Asian American cultural festivals, anime cons, and that sort of thing. When a good friend of mine who's an attorney told me that, he said, Simon, I think you should get a registration on your trademark. And I was like, really? He said, yeah, it's something bands do all the time. It's really important for your career. I think you should do it. He said, don't worry, it's only a couple hundred bucks, and the whole thing is going to be over in like 6 months or less. So, like, let's just go ahead and do it. Little did I know that, almost a decade later, here I am in Washington, D.C., having gone before the Supreme Court today, that turned out a little bit different. You know, at the time when we received our first rejection, I thought it was a practical joke. He called me up, he says, Simon, I think, you know, we actually have a problem with your application. I said, well, you know, what is it? Did I fill something out incorrectly or something like that? He says, no. Well, that was fine. He says, they said your name is disparaging to persons of Asian descent. And I said, do they know we're of Asian descent? And he says, I think so. I'm not sure. And I was like, I didn't even know there was a law against this. There's all kinds of offensive stuff to have trademarks. So I was like, what does the law actually say? And he says, oh, that's easy. He says, well, It says that a substantial composite of the reference group, in that case, Asian Americans, has to find it disparaging. So I said, we just came off this tour. We just played for all these Asian festivals across this country. Who did they find that found it disparaging? And he said, well, nobody. I said, but they did cite UrbanDictionary.com. There's like a quote from you from Wikipedia that doesn't really sound like you. And he said, and they included a photograph of Miley Cyrus pulling her eyes back in a slant-eye gesture. And I was like, you gotta be kidding me. He says, no, no, I'm looking at Miley Cyrus right now. And it was so the kind of stuff that wouldn't be acceptable in like a junior high classroom is all of a sudden being used in a federal government system. And he says, yeah. He says, but I think they're off base. I think they got it wrong. So let's go ahead and appeal. We should be able to reply. And I think we'll be all right. Of course, that turned out a little bit differently than thought. You see, back in the day, when someone wanted to make an appeal, if they've been accused of this law called Section 2A of the Lanham Act, for all the law geeks out there who are like really obsessed with this particular thing, the traditional way of appealing was like you had to have dictionary experts, you had to have like community testimonies, organizations at your back, surveys. They say, here's all the things that we would like from you. Well, you know what? We gave them all those things. We had an independent national survey. We had a dictionary expert who was an editor at the New American Oxford Dictionary and one of the top linguistics experts in the country do a 70-page report on the history of the term slant and how Asian Americans had been proactively reappropriating it for like decades now. National independent survey showed 92 to 98% of Asian Americans supported our use of the name. We had dozens of examples. Almost every single Asian American media site in the country, every single press, every single magazine, radio show, TV show, supporting our use of the name, actively promoting our kind of social justice message. We had incarceration camp survivors, social justice organizations, all filing for us. And we thought, you know, this thing is huge. I mean, this is about a year into it now. My attorney says, you know what? We got a lot of great stuff. And I said, hey, I got one of those copy machines at work. You know, they got like the copier, they got the scanner, they got the printer. I was like, I can print all this out and scan it and send you the PDF so we don't have to pay for this at Kinko's anymore. He says, yeah, that's true. We could file it digitally, and they prefer it filed digitally. He's like, but I want to mail this thing. I want to pay for the shipping on this thing. It was like this thick. I mean, it was like huge. He says, we had to actually get a custom box for it. He says, I want to ship it because I want the trademark attorney to actually see the voice of your community and have to hand scan every one of those pages so he could think about what he's doing to your community by stripping away its rights to identify itself. And I was like, yo, I'll go in half on that. Like, that sounds like a great idea. We shipped it all to him, all this evidence, and they said no. They said, well, yeah, we got these legal declarations, but this online blog, which is from Stormfront, a white supremacist website, by the way, says that slants is disparaging. We have this dictionary that we're quoting from. It was printed in 1938 that says, oh, slant eyes, they're bad, so therefore it must be disparaging. In other words, every bit of evidence that you could find that wasn't actually a member of the Asian American community, and that it was considered more legitimate than the voice of my own community. And that's why we chose to fight. You know, finally I got a new attorney because my attorney was so burnt out fighting this law. I got a new attorney and he said, you know what? As long as you say you're not offensive, it's a losing argument. You're not gonna win. And I didn't realize it at the time that, you know, the trademark office said you can appeal. You could definitely appeal. But they don't tell you you can never win because nobody in the history of this country has ever won on appeal when they've been accused of violating this law. So he said, I got a different idea. Let's submit a new application and we won't tell them you're an Asian American band. There will be no pictures of Asian Americans in this file. you know, if we have concert flyers, they're going to be neutral. It'll be like Cars or something like that. Whatever concert flyers you have that don't have anything that could be construed as Asian or Asian American, we're going to file this thing. And the only thing Asian about it is your Chinese name. So I said, okay, I don't understand, but let's go ahead and do that. And so we go there, we apply, the trademark office gives us the same response. In fact, they give us the same examining attorney who copies and pastes his response onto our application. And I was like, how could he even do that? And our trademark team, they said, we got him. We got him. They just broke the rules. Because every time you apply, they're supposed to do a fresh search. It's like all their evidence predates your application by like 2 years. And the only time they ever found on their internet searches slants to be disparaging was when they actually put the word derogatory next to it and combined it with the N-word. And I said, so that was the only time. It's like, so it was a spiked result. It wasn't like an unbiased search to see like how people felt about it. And I thought, okay, you know, I trust you guys, and we proceeded on. And during that kind of examination, we found out a lot more about the government's position. We asked them, we said, hold on a second, you've registered slant over 800 times. If it is a racial slur, like you claim it is, why did you register all these trademarks, but you denied this one? In fact, I'm the only one to have ever been denied a registration for slant, ever, on the premise of it being racist towards Asians. So they're like, why? And they said, oh, that's easy. And the quote from the trademark office is, it is incontestable that the applicant is of Asian descent and part of an Asian band. Wrap your heads around that one. Basically, what they're saying is anyone can trademark the slants as long as they're not Asian. Because for them, if people went to theslants.com, in fact, they actually wrote this, like, we went to the website, theslants.com, and the imagery, quote-unquote, was Asian. The imagery he was referring to was my face, like the people in my band, Asian Americans. And he says, if people see that kind of imagery and combine with the words the slants, they're going to automatically think of the racial slur instead of any other possible definition for the word. So we had some kind of, you know, snarky responses like, well, how many Asian members of the band does Simon have to fire in place of white people before it's okay? You know, what about people who are of mixed race? Are they okay? And all these questions that the trademark office conveniently didn't answer. And of course, this particular journey and that path of arguments led us through a lot of legal stuff and ended up at the Supreme Court, where we're now fighting to say whether or not the law that was used against me is constitutional. And, you know, over all these years, the people keep asking me, like, why did you fight? Like, why did you keep doing this? Surely you thought it wasn't worth it. And I'll say, yeah, it cost me tens of thousands of dollars to fight this trademark case. And that's with attorneys working pro bono for us. It's cost me, you know, almost about a fifth of my life that I will never get back. And what people don't say, and what they oftentimes gloss over in media reports when they talk about what the actual cost is that part of that cost is forever being associated with a racist football team. Part of that cost is having the government say it is indisputable, that it's a fact that I am racist towards Asian Americans, that my little social justice project is racist. That's part of the cost of forever in the history books, according to the government, of being a racist. But to me, if in the end we have a more equitable law, it's worth it. Because we found out this law isn't just used against bands who want to play rock and roll called the Slants. It's not just used to cancel trademarks for a football team. In fact, the law, when you look at who gets trademarks and who don't get trademarks based on like what's considered, you know, offensive, they disproportionately apply this law to people of color and members of the LGBTQ community, especially those engaged in reappropriation. People want to reclaim stereotypes, people who have something really important to say about society. And that's why I decided all those costs are going to be worth it if I could strike down a law that allowed the government to use my own race against me, a law that justified institutional racism. That's why we chose to fight. You know, the really funny thing is that one part of the government, like, thinks we're racist, but many other parts have no problem with us whatsoever. Just 2 months ago, our band released a song called From the Heart. It was a part of a collaboration with none other than the White House. The White House Initiative of Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders, who called us champions of the Asian American community. You know, involving people like Barack and Michelle Obama, Jeremy Lin, George Takei. Like, to be a part of that, it's really funny because one branch of the government like says, we need you, please join with us in this effort. Another's like, shut up, change your name because you're racist. Another example is like, we spent the holidays of the troops serving overseas, another involved a federal prison. Over and over again, the government actually asks me to advocate on their behalf to help increase Asian American voting rates, to develop policies that are more equitable or beneficial to marginalized communities. So on one hand, whenever they need us, they come crawling, asking for us to help them. And then the other, they're just straight up labeling us racist. It's part of the kind of ironies of this particular journey. And I just want to close with two particular stories that kind of, I think, really express and kind of capture what it is that we do in the slants. And then we're going to play acoustically. You know, we couldn't fly with all our music instruments to the court or anything like that. So we got a couple of guitars, we'll jam, have a nice little intimate session where you could preview some of our new content. So one time, this was back in 2012, we were contacted by the Oregon State Penitentiary to perform for inmates there. And I was just really excited. I was excited at the time because I was like, oh man, Johnny Cash played in the prison. Like, this is straight up like Folsom Prison Blues. It's gonna be awesome. However, it didn't cross my mind what that meant. What it meant going to the Oregon State Penitentiary system. But because most people don't know this, I'll explain. What makes Oregon really special is that we have one of the highest populations of white supremacists in the prison. So I didn't really think, like, what's it like sending an Asian band into that environment? It didn't cross my mind as I was filling out their paperwork, signing off the releases, saying, yeah, it's cool if we get, you know, maimed, stabbed, shanked, killed, our families won't sue. And I was like, you know, you gotta like sign these waivers just to go into high school these days, that's fine. It didn't really cross our mind as we had to do an inventory of every single thing we were bringing into the prison, including they had to physically count every single guitar pick and drumstick that we were bringing in. It only crossed my mind as we were being handed these really bright neoprene orange vests going in with these numbers, like we're gonna go play flag football or something like that. You know, we're going through the security, they take our ideas and hand us these nasty vests that clearly haven't been washed in a long time. And our singer at the time says, hey, hold on a second, like, you know, we wear suits, we got vests when we play. Is it cool if we, like, take these off, you know, when we're changing on stage or something like that? It's a really hot day, it's the middle of summer. And the guard looks at us and he says, yeah, that's fine if you want to take them off. It's like, but if something happens out there, those vests let us know who not to shoot. So I was like, yo, can I get two of them vests? Seriously. You know, then that's when it all hit me. I was like, well, hold on a second. Like, what do I actually know about prisons? All I could think of were like what I learned from TV shows and films and books. And let me tell you, this is before Orange is the New Black was on. There was not a lot of good representation of what entailed or what happened behind bars. You walk through and I start thinking, you know, who are the people they send to these things? You know, drug dealers, rapists, murderers, like, who's gonna be out there? Finally, they take us to a place that they call the Big Yard. It's about 2 football fields in length, huge, surrounded by these 20-foot concrete walls with sentry towers placed. You can see the spotlights and the machine guns mounted everywhere, all around us. And at the end of this field was a little concrete stage, about the same height as this one, where we were to set up. Now, the only thing separating us and about 2,000 inmates for this experience was about half a dozen orange safety cones and like yellow police tape that said, "Police, do not cross." And I was like, I don't know if they pay attention to instructions like that. That's why they're here, right? And they're like, no, you know. They're like, well, we have a plan. I was like, well, what's the plan? Because it'd be good for us to know. And they said, if something happens, drop everything and run away. That's your plan? They're like, we got guards that, you know, they'll take care of it. And they're like, and we want you to run through this fence right here. Someone will be on the other side. I'm like, yeah, the protected side. Someone will open it for you, and then we'll close it when you're done running. And I was like, okay, well, that's what we got into, right? So we begin performing, and, you know, this is their only hour of outdoor time that they have. So I can understand that there weren't a whole lot in the beginning paying attention, maybe only a couple hundred. But as we covered the Rolling Stones song, Painted Black, like a crowd kind of started amassing and they started like rocking out with us. And it became really incredible. You know, we finished up, and as I'm standing there, just kind of thinking about the whole experience, I was standing next to one of those, you know, said orange safety cones next to that police tape. And my band members breaking down gear, talking to some other guys. And I look over and like these five very large white men start walking towards me. Men who are covered in tattoos that say white power and swastikas and all manner of things that didn't make me think they would be friendly towards me or people who look like me. And so I get like, you know, that anxious feeling again. I look over and I look for a guard, and he's breaking up a fight elsewhere. And I was like, okay. Turn back around. And all of a sudden, they're in front of me. And the guy in front, who, you know, I swear, he's blocking out the sun, even though I think he was actually shorter than me, hands me a piece of paper and then, like, a really sharp pencil. And I just stare at him. And he says, "Can I get your autograph?" You know, I didn't even know how to respond at the moment. I was like, And he says, "It's for my daughter." He says, "It's because I did a lot of bad. They're not things that I want my little girl to do. They're mistakes I don't want her to make." And he says, "You know, I know what you must think." It's like, "But even if I can't change what's stained into my skin, I could change what's in my heart, what's in my mind." It's like, "I'm seeing you guys here today. I realized maybe I was wrong. Maybe I was a little bit wrong. I'm not saying I was completely wrong." He's like, "But maybe a little bit." He's like, "But I would love to tell my daughter that I met the band today." I learned later on that we were actually originally brought into that prison to help reduce violence against the Asian American inmates that were incarcerated there. And after we left, violence went down. Another time, the Department of Defense asked us to help them out and kind of go overseas to play for the troops. And I just kept thinking, like, because this is all at the same time as me fighting the trademark, the battle that I was waging. And I kept thinking, like, you know, the trademark regime is like a prison too. It's designed to keep ideas in. Those that are appropriate get to stay in, and that we need to use them and to protect. Or sorry, the bad ideas are getting locked in to be protected from the rest of society, regardless of context. But I knew that the system, just like our prison system, needed reform and change. You know, and later that year, Department of Defense asked us because, for those of you who are familiar with the kind of news of Asian Americans during that time period, there were such extreme hazing practices that Asian American soldiers were committing suicide or being killed when they joined the military. So they asked us to go over there to kind of bring some quote unquote cultural awareness around the holidays, and they called it Operation Gratitude, so that we can kind of provide some, you know, well, so that they can actually meet some Asian Americans themselves and have a conversation with them that weren't their fellow soldiers. We toured around Eastern Europe, but there's a very particular night in Kosovo that I will always remember. And for those of you not familiar with Kosovo or the geography of it, it's really cold, especially in the winter where we were. And there was snow piling up everywhere. And when they showed us to our stage that was outdoors, I was like, oh, man, like, this is not gonna go well. There are two gas lamp heaters for the entire space. But we go, and we're like, we got layers and layers and layers on. We start performing, and there's like maybe 15 soldiers there, because no one wanted to be out there in the cold. But they start like shouting, like screaming and dancing and having such a good time that all of a sudden the Austrian army was doing some drills and they're walking by and they're like, what's going on with the crazy Americans? And they come in and they start joining the party. And then the Belgians and then the German army, because this was a NATO base, so it was international forces, right? And so they all come in and the place begins to be filled with soldiers from all around the world dancing to the Native American dance rock band. And our little 30-minute set or so turned into 2.5 hours out there in the cold, dancing with all these soldiers, making them feel appreciated for their service. We go outside, and we're breaking down gear, loading into the van, and this older man walks up to me. And I don't know a lot about the military, but I do know that if you got a lot of stars on your soldier, you're probably kind of important. He's got all these metal things and ribbons everywhere. And he comes up and he's like, hey, you know, I'm the commander of this base. I represent the troops. I want to say thank you. And I was like, oh, you know, hey, thanks for having us. And he says, but I also have to clear something up. And like that sushi restaurant incident, he keeps on talking. He kind of just left it at that, but he kept on talking. He said, I have to actually apologize. He says, because when I first looked at that poster and I saw the slants that you're doing this thing you call Chinatown dance rock, I was like, I don't know anything about Oriental music or what like Oriental people do with this kind of music, but I didn't think I wanted anything to do with it. But I came here because it's my job. I usually pop in for about 10 minutes and I go back to my office and work before going to bed. And he said, but I have to tell you, I'm sorry because I was wrong. I shouldn't have judged you Oriental people like that. I'll never do that again because that was so incredible. It's like, we've never had a response like that. We've had Joan Jett, we've had so many incredible artists, and we've never seen them take the time to spend that, make sure every single soldier felt appreciated that night. He's like, so thank you on behalf of the US government, thank you. And so here I was, put in that situation again, thinking, what do I say to like this commander of this base that made, I don't know, maybe he can get me killed right now, I don't know. I just said, thank you so much for having me. Thank you, it was an honor and privilege to perform for all of you, thank you. Don't use Oriental again, because that's straight up racist, man, but thank you. I jumped in the van and we took off. And that's been the kind of the similar situations time and time again that we've had in this particular band. And so now we'd love to kind of share some of our music and some of our tunes with you, but I just want to thank you because like I think it's really important. Like, you know, you hear about this big case, Lee versus Tam, going before the Supreme Court, and you don't really hear the stories of what it's like, who they're actually affecting, who those decisions are affecting. And this is the band that I started over, you know, that I had imagined about a decade ago. A band that I believe would fundamentally change the world by providing representation for our community. And now, hopefully, we're changing an outdated racist law. So thank you so much for listening to me, and we're going to transition here and play some rock and roll for you.
I'm not gonna bootleg your music here. I'm gonna tell people tell people to go buy the album.
Go buy our album.
the band
that must not be named.
Yes, thank you so much.
Or the band who must not be named.
This is Gunn from the podcast, The Indefensible Middle Ground, signing off. Go buy their album.